At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing Jordan Peterson, David French, and toxic effeminacy. This is a very interesting collaboration that was done. And Jordan Peterson deserves a lot of criticism for bringing David French on. And I think because, first of all, on the topic of masculinity, it's just David French is not someone we should be looking up to. And it'll show in the conversation. And what my kind of opening thoughts were on the conversation between Jordan Peterson and David French is, first of all, they really don't have any solutions to offer. They do not have any meaningful solutions to offer. And so, and anyone can point out a problem, but, and a lot of people made money just pointing out problems, but not anyone can point out a solution. And perhaps the only real meaningful insight is, I thought, in the conversation at all, was Jordan Peterson's point about the ADHD crisis. I thought that was the strongest point in the conversation, and really the only one that was of any insight, but it wasn't necessarily relevant to the conversation about men and what's getting men down and stuff like that. So, but there was a lot of ego stroking and circle jerking going on in the conversation between David French and Jordan Peterson. So I thought that might be a more logical explanation for why they are doing that. But with that said, I'll let you get your opening thoughts in, and then I'll kind of explain what I think the direction of Jordan Peterson is and where it's going based on this conversation alone.
So I mean, yeah, in many ways, he's almost trying to be like a centrist Tucker Carlson, which I don't know will actually work. But one thing that became clear is, like, you always wonder, okay, what is the impetus for this conversation? Obviously, Tucker Carlson just had an interview with the president of Iran. So you obviously know what the impetus for that conversation is. We just bombed Iran. And you're wondering, what is the impetus for this conversation with David French? Of all people, why is Jordan Peterson talking with David French? And the answer is a New York Times op-ed that French wrote that really doesn't have anything to say. But let's just be honest, the first quarter of the article had a lot of praise for one named Jordan Peterson. It's like, what is Jordan Peterson like about the article? Well, maybe it's the first quarter of it, because overall, David French doesn't really have anything to say. And he basically blames the issue of Democrats on men on Donald Trump, of all people. So he basically just does the almost like the David French meme of making it about Donald Trump.
I'm not trying to be the Ed Litton to J.D. Hall's J.D. Greer. But he had an excellent point that I think is also true about Jordan Peterson could not go far. You know, he refused to notice, and he refused to, you know, take any side with the noticers. So he's gone to a hard, he's starting to do a hard left rebound. So he's kind of going back to the left. And you're seeing that with a lot of people, a lot of personalities. They would only get so right, and once they decided that they weren't going to, you know, embrace or reject religious pluralism and stuff like that, and notice, you know, pagan behaviors and patterns, they were going to go left again. And that is what Jordan Peterson has done. And to me, his invitation of David French, someone who has been ostracized out of conservatism
for quite some time, too.
Yeah, not even, it's not a recent development. It is something that happened basically in 2016 to 2018. Whenever he wrote the Drag Queen Story Hour is a Blessing of Liberty nonsense, And he's also defended, like, parents transgendering their children. He's defended that as a parental right. This guy's gay affirming. That's why it's in the thumbnail of the video. As is Ted Cruz, for what it's worth. But, you know, different. We already talked about him. But anyway, I have a very strict standard on what is gay affirming. But it's based on the fact that, you know, no one before recent history believed, you know, that certain things should be legal. But anyway, yeah, this is a hard left pivot for Jordan Peterson to be partnering and collaborating with David French, especially on the topic of masculinity, which is not something that David French is known for, and his presentation and delivery is not good. I'm just saying, anytime you listen to David French talk, honestly, he's up there with Francis Chan on how insufferable his voice is to listen to.
Yeah, a lot of estrogen. You can just feel it.
Yeah. So, and I don't have the biggest radio voice, but it's something about his voice. Anyway, let's start with the article that you said was the impetus for the video and the interview. So you've basically pasted it onto a Word document. So we don't have to deal with the New York Times or doing the archive version of the New York Times article.
And you got some highlights that are helpful. I mean, you can kind of see from the beginning of the article. I mean, third paragraph in, he mentions Jordan Peterson and 12 rules for life and how he was in the military. And again, he goes through a lot of this in the interview with Peterson. So there's a lot of like one for one crossover between what he does here. Here's where he talks about the whole Democrat problem and their analysis, which they're getting roasted for. But you never actually hear him articulate what the Democrats' solution is.
Let's point this out. The Democrats are actually pretty open about discussing the fact that they have a men problem.
Yeah, they're open to that problem, but
their solutions so far have been to embrace degeneracy. And have I missed anything? It's really just to embrace degeneracy. That's the only solution that they're really offering men.
I would just say it's sit down in the chair. Like that's their only solution.
Sit down in the chair and enjoy unlimited internet, and this is ectoplasm. That is really their only solution for men. That's what they're offering men. So we're against age verification laws. There you go, men. There you go.
Now, again, I mean, I didn't put notes on this, but I will critique the whole boys commit suicide at higher rates than girls, which that part's true. Boys have higher mental health problems than girls. That's totally untrue. And the SSRI medication data pretty much proves that. And yes, the ADHD thing is true, but it is overdiagnosed, which I guess ties into why Peterson addressed it in the conversation.
Okay.
I mean, I think the fatherlessness issue is largely overstated, even though, yes, there is a lack of like strong male role models. But obviously, they're not willing to understand disparate impact and how that might impact a lot of data. Because again,
another thing is that autism is definitely becoming a thing that's getting scammed for state resources, like the Somalis in Minnesota.
Yes.
Using that system.
Andrew Isker has long talked about. So here's where the article really gets interesting, where French starts saying he's talking about the manosphere and trying to relate that to politics. So he reads, if there's one thing that they all have in common, it's that the manosphere influencers approach young men from a perceived place of love and affection. I like you was the message. I want you to live a good life. Let me show you how. The contrast with the approach of the cultural left was profound. Men could see that there was much love for women on the left, but they didn't see the same regard for men. Slogans like the future's female created the impression that the sexes were in competition and women would win. For women to win, men had to lose. And let me just say, first and foremost, like, French just does not comprehend that politics is inherently, by nature, it is zero sum. In order for someone to win, someone else has to lose. In order for women to be elevated, men have to be cast as...
You can have a lose-lose compromise. Maybe you can have a win-win compromise, but you're not going to have that win-win-win. So majority of the time, it's going to be win-lose. And maybe you can have a lose-lose, which is kind of what was glorified as Republicans and Democrats coming together. You know, lose-lose compromise, lose-lose outcome. But really, most of time, you know, America's been losing all of our lives. And for, you know, I think that the passage of the BBB was a win-lose. Because we won, they lost. And hopefully there's mass deportations, which is we win, they lose. Like, there is no come together. It's not a zero-sum game. No, it's completely a zero-sum game. And we're going to get into that a little bit more when we get into the interview itself. But you're pointing out that, you know, there's a gender war, and there's only so much, you know, one... You're pointing out that David French or the Democrats have to are competing for women, which does come at the expense of men.
Well, it inherently does. You're giving from men to women. You're giving what, tax dollars for welfare programs? Because again, it's not gamer bros that are abusing the welfare system. That, and again, Mike Johnson says this, Tommy Loren says this, Megyn Kelly probably would say this too. But all these like people on the right blame the gamer bros for abusing the welfare system when it's basically single mothers, but they don't want to actually say that because that would paint a very sexist picture. But yeah, I mean, again, but even on a micro level in everyday life, in order for you to get the job offer, that means someone else has to lose. And when corporations enact DEI policies, that means that typically white men are losing, even though they're better qualified on average. So yes, DEI, and again, women are the biggest beneficiaries of DEI. White women, not minorities, white women. So again, they're building an entire system around taking from men, taking from white people, and giving it to other groups, their groups.
Yeah, it's a social redistribution.
Yes. And again, what man wants to follow and serve a woman? I mean, that's just, again, you're in the chair. And then,
yeah,
again,
and that's why it's the Kamala Harris, you know, for David French to vote for Kamala Harris and then offer anything to men, it just, it rings so hollow because it's just so, there's such a level of castration. Men don't want to follow a eunuch, a spiritual eunuch either.
Yeah. And he kind of makes the point in the video and also in the article about, you know, men need their aggression channeled and you can't go without mentioning World War II, but he doesn't actually say how the Democrats can relay that. There's no message or product that the Democrats can offer men. He doesn't have that because there isn't any.
Well, there is. It's degeneracy.
Well, yeah. Degeneracy, what? Gambling, porn. Yeah.
Weed.
Weed. Here you go. Vape instead of Zen. So again, and then when the APA published the, and continuing on, published a report in 2019 arguing for that traditional masculinity marked by stoicism, competitiveness, dominance, and aggression is on whole harmful. The message seemed clear. Men, you don't have the problem. You are the problem. Well, yeah. And again, Democrats kind of embodied that. And then he kind of, there's his World War II stance. And then here it is where Donald Trump becomes the problem. And he eventually says, and the marriage of the manosphere to Donald Trump. To Donald Trump means that too many men are doubling down on the worst versions of themselves. Again, he can't make the problem not about Donald Trump.
So just to go back and do a history lesson, David French is the poster child for, like, the OG poster child for Donald Trump derangement syndrome. This is someone who was at one point kind of decently right wing, or at least a little bit right of the modern neocons, right? And then he's done a hard left. You know, David French used to defend Confederate statues and stuff like that. And I don't think you'd catch him doing that at all. And he's gone so left wing that he got canceled by the PCA last year, which is great. And, you know, he's basically taking a lot of dark money from liberal organizations to influence the church. That's the type of person, that's the type of man that David French is. And all this has to do, in large part, with his TDS, his Trump derangement syndrome. He is the OG at that. and it has to manifest itself here.
Yeah, I mean, basically he's trying to say that, okay, they're just being anti-woke. They're not forming a path. I mean, we can even go on to making matters worse. They celebrate aggression and defiance as a form of strength and moral courage. They're defying woke establishment and forging their own path. But becoming anti-left or anti-feminist is not the same thing as becoming pro-male. Misogyny should be the anathema to any truly virtuous definition of masculinity. And again, it does go back to, in order for women to be elevated and have to lose, or, and again, the left will always castigate taking things away as hatred. Oh, you don't want, you know, gay people to exist, therefore you must hate them. You want abortion outlawed, therefore you hate women. Which again, that would be called misogyny. So there's really nothing new. I mean, again, not caring about what women think about politics is, I mean, as John Doyle say, the future is determined by our willingness to ignore the, like, the crying of women and minorities. Like, that's determines the future of America.
Yeah, this is a very critical juncture, because Trump, I used to say that Elon Musk was the barometer for normies, but it's actually Donald Trump right now. He's the barometer for normies right now. Because, you know, Elon Musk has crashed out, but Donald Trump is very much a boomer and is very much a normie, but he is a more persuadable boomer.
I mean, he proves that, you know, monarchy is a better form of government than democracy, because we have more sway as individuals and just a regular nons on Twitter with Donald Trump than you do with your own congressman.
Yeah. Let alone in any election.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing you can do to convince Ted Cruz of anything. But you can at least get Donald Trump to do something for you.
Right.
And then,
which will come up because David French worships democracy.
And then here's kind of the ending where, you know, the answer to the manosphere's dark turn is rooted in embracing men with sincere affection, shunning the zero-sum calculus of the gender wars, and offering a version of masculinity. A vision of masculine virtue that inspires men to heroic acts of compassion rather than vicious acts of aggression. Again, politics is zero sum. There's nothing that Democrats can offer men that doesn't involve taking away from the groups that there are already within their patronage network. And again, even just turning off the faucet would be giving men something, but that would be taking away from their other groups. Because again, the entire conception for a lot of groups in America is just white people have, we want what they have. That's Zoran Mondani's entire brand in New York City. It's just taking from, you know, the white people. Oh, they have money. Their neighborhoods are richer. Let's tax them more. Like that is that third world mindset is going to be a rising faction on the left.
Yeah, because they're increasingly not going to be American.
Yeah, and they're increasingly going to see heritage Americans as having stuff that they want, and they're going to use government to get it. That's what happened in Rhodesia. That's what happened in South Africa. Also, technically, what happened in Haiti, and why Haiti is Haiti. So, I mean, that's kind of the end of the article. He doesn't actually have a message. Like, I mean, we can even read his final paragraph. America doesn't need a left-wing version of Joe Rogan. What it needs is our parents, pastors, teachers, and coaches to fill the void of young men's heart. Our sons should not have to turn to books or podcasts or social media to hear this simple and powerful message. I like you. I want you to live a good life. Let me show you how. Okay, how are the Democrats going to show young men how to live a life? What does Kamala Harris have to offer young men that somehow made David French vote for her? Because Donald Trump has something to offer.
So take it off screen for a second. So with that said, Andrew Tate has something to offer young men. It is counterfeit. I don't think it's real because I think Andrew Tate is completely fake. So Andrew Tate's completely fake, but he is offering something. He's at least selling snake oil. That's a lot better than Chris Rufo, who's saying work at Panda Express.
Yeah, work a menial job that has zero status, which zero status means you can't get married because women want status.
Yeah. And I mean, what are women going to go for? Your average woman, so maybe not the women in this audience, but what are they more inclined to be attracted to? Doctor lawyer in New York, you know, doctor lawyer making six figures, or a Buc-ee's manager making six figures? Now, that's hard work.
Everyone likes Buc-ee's.
Everybody loves Buc-ee's, but I don't know. Is that enough status symbol of like you're working at Buc-ee's making six figures as opposed to doctor lawyer making six figures? I don't know. I mean, imagine the hours are going to be somewhat similar. But there is something about status that is neglected. Now, again, you know, there's a lot of money that you can make in the trades, but largely the status is going to come from ownership in the work that you do. But that's a discussion for at least another day, but that's definitely part of the mission, because I see that as the solution is like, you know, Christians owning their own businesses, which gives them status, which gives them more access to capital, which gives them more ability to do social change. And I definitely subscribe to the Stephen Wolfe view of evangelism, that social elites modeling Christian behavior is more effective in apologetics than any debate about natural revelation or Thomism versus presuppositional apologetics. You know, top-down evangelism works and is the history of the church. You know, Christianity exploded. I mean, it was already at a critical mass at the beginning of the 4th century, but it exploded in the 4th century. Christianity exploded in Armenia, also in the 4th century, I believe, or very late 3rd century. Exploded in Armenia because the king became a Christian. They're the first Christian nation in the history of the world. And they became such because the king got converted. So, yeah, I think evangelism historically is top down and people follow the god or gods of the leader. And you see that in Israel, in the Old Testament, that when the king worshiped a false god, that led the entire nation astray. So, going back to, I don't know if you had anything to add before we get into the video clips from the interview itself.
Yeah, I mean, again, the Democrats don't actually have a message. Like, and again, he's even suggesting that there is a product that the Democrats have that they just need to market it better. And then that will win them elections and, you know, fight back against the big, bad, mean Donald Trump. But there is no message. Their message is basically, we're taking from you.
And they just need to be told, I like you.
Yeah, we'll pacify you. That's all the Democrats can do is just pacify, particularly young white men.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, I like you, and I want you to live a good life, and let me show you how. Like, what? First of all, in an article about the Democrats, how are they going to do that? Like,
yeah, they spent $20 million, but you don't actually express at any point why or how they could have spent that $20 million better.
And that's kind of the frustration. We'll get into the second clip, which is it is the closest that David French comes to offering a solution, but we've kind of alluded to it in the article, but it's the closest that he comes is in the second clip. But this is clip one. We have three clips for tonight. We're going to watch him at 1.4. I listened to this at 1.75 very comfortably. So I think 1.4 is good enough for that. Okay. Statistics man says, I don't know, man, Texas women might be into Buc-ee's managers. Okay, so I'm just saying they make comparable incomes. And it's funny. It's funny to me, but Buc-ee's, you deserve that. And anyway.
The things that are ripping America apart will begin to ease if we can deal with this loneliness, this alienization, this lack of belonging. And so even if you're just cold-blooded about it, like even if you're like, well, I just want American politics to be less dysfunctional, America to be less divided, just dealing with the issue that is besetting, again, particularly young men, is an imperative. So it's an imperative morally, it's an imperative culturally, it's an imperative politically, and if you have an ounce of love in your heart for people, it's just an imperative spiritually. I've been a Christian evangelical conservative my entire life. I voted for Kamala Harris, the first Democrat I voted for in national election in my life. So I have been a conservative. I was a delegate to the 2012 Republican convention. I've been a Christian conservative my entire life, and have volunteered for Republican campaigns. In 1988, joined the College Republicans at my small Christian college that I attended in Nashville. And very different experience from my law school, which was very liberal. My small Christian college was super conservative. And it was so conservative that we realized as College Republicans that we had no more votes to get for George H.W. Bush over Dukakis. But yeah, I've been a conservative and my entire life and a Republican. I'm not a Republican anymore, but I've been a Republican most of my adult life.
You have written.
So let's talk about David French for a second, because the guy is a liar. Like, he's saying that he's a conservative and he's a Christian, but his views have drastically went liberal. And some of them have remained consistent. He's always been a neocon, or in this case, he's a neo-lib. But as far as his social views go, the guy's gone completely liberal.
Yeah. Do you think he actually would have believed drag queen story hours, the price of freedom, or in transgender medication?
In 1988,
with George H.W. Bush on the ballot? No. No. Gay marriage was such a niche issue in that time.
But here's one thing that I do think that he's consistent about. He does not want power to be wielded for good. I think that's actually pretty consistent. If we're not toppling, you know, dictators in the Middle East, I don't want the government to wield the sword at all. I think that's a pretty consistent stance that David French has had his entire life.
Yeah, I mean, it is that sort of pietism which just accelerates the problems that they're lamenting in this entire video. But at the end of the day, they don't want the strong man that will come in and solve the problems, but they don't want the problems to exist. So all they're doing is making the problem worse.
All right. Just wanted to get back.
And again, the solutions that come will be worse than what Donald Trump is doing now, or worse or more severe or more harsh. Like, if it's not Donald Trump, it's going to be more, you know, Frankelish.
Yeah, Donald Trump, like I said, is the normie. He's the moderate solution.
Like that's
and really, I think he's a stepping stone, because this might be the best we're going to get with a boomer president. Like, and I don't think we're going to have another boomer president, because I think the next president is going to be millennial J.D. Vance. And J.D. Vance is already signaling that he's a lot more right-wing than Donald Trump at the moment. So,
for The Atlantic and for The New York Times.
Why do they allow you to write for them?
Well, you know, they were actually looking for a pro-life person when they were trying to hire a new columnist, actually looking for somebody who was conservative and somebody who had, you know, I'm also a veteran. I don't believe there were any columnists who were veterans. I'm also a lawyer. I don't believe at the time of my hiring that there were any other columnists who were lawyers. I'm
that's
a constitutional lawyer. So, you know, I think that's the overall mix, but you know, you'd have to ask my boss as to why. But I was very pleasantly surprised, I'll be honest with you, when I got the job offer. It was definitely not something I was seeking out, but it came to me, and I was very grateful and thankful, and I've had a really good experience there.
Getting the most out of life means being prepared for whatever comes your way, but many of us don't realize that a simple will doesn't actually cover all aspects of estate planning.
All right. Your thoughts on that part?
I mean, him talking about working in liberal media, I don't think I was surprised that he was working with the New York Times. That seemed like the most expected thing in the world.
Oh, it was a very unsurprising development, as well as the Dispatch, which is one of the organizations he helped launch, and how they just hired a transvestite.
Which he celebrated, which yes, again, he probably would never have celebrated that in 1988 with Dukakis and George H.W. Bush on the ballot.
So,
yeah, the college Republicans at some small Christian college would have anathematized him.
Right. And again, the New York Times and the Atlantic are not serious about getting people from the other side. He's just the latest iteration of Jennifer Rubin, who was a Washington Post Republican that was anti-Trump. So they're not interested in having someone who can articulate the views of the other side. They're having someone they're interested in having someone that claims to represent the other side, but says their talking points.
Yeah, because again, he doesn't actually represent the other side, because he openly hates Donald Trump. Like, you can't claim to represent the, you know, the 50%+ of Americans who voted for him at the New York Times. Like, you're not actually representing the other side. You actually voted for Kamala Harris, just like the other New York.
Yeah, so you're not a conservative by definition, just for that alone. So he's a liberal, but he gets to play a conservative on newspaper. Not even TV. But in this case, he's playing a conservative on Jordan Peterson's video, which I gotta say, Actually, maybe now's a good time to talk about us. This did not do the numbers. As you can see, Jordan Peterson has 8.73 million subs on YouTube, and this video got 76,000 views. These numbers are not good. Now, again, Jordan Peterson's probably got so many subs that it would probably be very hard for him to have like a successful interview like this, but this video did not do the numbers. There's not a large audience compared to his subscribers. Keep in mind, his own subscribers did not really watch this video. There's not a whole large audience interested in Jordan Peterson's audience, that is, interested in watching him interview David French. So,
yeah, I mean, I think he just did like Scott Adams, and I think that would do far better. Because Scott Adams is at least interesting, even though he's actually, you know, kind of on the left, but he's at least far more interesting than...
Because Scott Adams was kind of like, wasn't he kind of like...
Well, he just said...
How are you right about certain events in 2020? No, seriously. Like, you didn't believe us at the time.
Well, but Scott Adams was canceled for saying the obvious truth out loud that he doesn't want to live in a multiracial neighborhood because... You know, there goes the neighborhood happens. Like, he didn't, like, he said that out loud, and that's why he got canceled.
Right. And, you know, I know he's got some major health concerns at the moment. So I'm not wishing him ill, but I do find that frustrating when people say, how could you have been right sooner than I was right?
And the answer is the same. Football coaches. Some of the best men I've ever encountered are football coaches who have been able to socialize young men and take this energy, this drive, this aggression, and create it into and turn it into a brotherhood, turn it into a community, turn it into a fellowship that is pouring into fighting for each other the right way. And so I've seen a football coach be incredibly instrumental in a young man's life by taking all of that that's in them, all that stew that's in them, and molding it and channeling them and turning them into tremendous citizens and turning them into good teammates and good friends. And you will meet so many former football players who will say, the person who changed my life as much or more than my father, depending on the relationship with their father, was their football coach. And then you will find men who will say, one of the most malignant influences in my entire life was my football coach, because he taught me to hurt people. He taught me to inflict pain. He told me that rage and aggression were my friend. I should cultivate them and burn, you know. And I've actually seen different kinds of coaches. And so I would say that, you know, one of the interesting realities of life is that and this goes all way back. If you go back to
Can we do a fact check on what he's saying? Because I do believe that he's correct in the positive, just because I think it's obvious that a lot of men would look up to former football coaches. But the reason why they would say that this guy hurt me so much in my life, I think would have more to do with being used. Not, he taught me to hurt people.
No, you're talking about, hey, he overplayed me.
He used me and, you know, he just wanted a job. He didn't really care about me. He just wanted to advance his own career and stuff like that.
Okay, so
College transfer portal, the thing that led to the college transfer portal where, you know, coaches, it's their game too. Like, they advance their own careers and they promise a kid that they're going to be there for all 4 years to help them develop. And then they're just out after 6 months.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you're playing football, especially at any sort of high level, you probably have heard like the verbal berating of your coach, like, you know, numerous times in your development as a player. So yeah, like the verbal abuse, like the stuff that you see in Last Chance U, especially like those first two seasons, probably par for the course.
I'll give a pop culture reference because you just did Friday Night Lights and how the players were hurt by the coach leaving after the first season when they won the championship or whatever. Like that is what I'm talking about would actually be more of a devastation than even the mean words, I think.
Yeah.
Even though there might be some, who was that Miami Dolphins player that was like a total wimp? And Sam Martin or something, and got like Richie Incognito or whatever in trouble. Even, you know, that guy's not a like, great guy, but you know, there's just nothing there.
I mean, there's also the Jay Gruden, you know, he's got big lips on, or the lips on him,
right?
Like, talking about a black player, and it's just like he got like blacklisted, even though it's like
not he's just talking about a player, but talking about like a union NFLPA union representative.
Yeah, I mean, he's even though he's like a very successful coach.
Yeah. I believe he won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, Tampa.
So I think what he's saying about why coaches are would be viewed as powerfully in the negative direction is wrong.
Yeah.
Or the reason why is wrong. So I think it would have more to do with either being used to advance his own career or being like overused as a player to the point of you're being ran into the ground and hurt because the coach is trying to stat pad himself and look good. Stuff like that.
June 6th, 1944, on Normandy Beach, you had two different kinds of young male acculturation confronting each other on that pivotal day in world history, where you had one, a generation of youth acculturated into cruelty, into viciousness. And yes, they were very lethal, and they were very well trained, and they were very proficient in the profession of arms, which caused a lot of people to admire them, but they were cruel and they were vicious while they were lethal. And then on the other side, you had the forces of American and British democracy and Canadian democracy as well. One of the beaches was Canadian, right? So you had these coming across the channel. They weren't perfect people and they weren't perfect cultures, but these young men were acculturated to use their sense of their courage and their aggression to defeat cruelty, to protect the weak, to protect the vulnerable. And it is striking to me, how that virtuous masculinity, that virtuous courage and aggression so comprehensively triumphed in World War II. I'm reading this book right now about the fall of Berlin. And this is a great lesson in why you shun cruelty and you exhibit compassion. At the very end of the war, when Nazi Germany was collapsing, people were falling all over themselves to come to the American side and to escape the Soviet side. And so this was something where not only by our valor did we win the war, our compassion also helped us win the war. And that's when I'm looking at this little angel and devil on the young man's shoulder. I've often think of the bad coach and the good coach, or at the most extreme, and I don't know, gosh, I'm a middle-aged man, so I guess I always have to talk about World War II at some point in it. And, you know, at the extremes, you have the pure evil of fascism and communism and the virtuous valor of a democracy awakened. And these are the angels and devils that are always on the shoulder of young men here. And look, I know that there are parallels with women, but we're talking about men. These are the angels and devils that are on young men's shoulders. And you're exactly right. A lot of young men will be drawn to that devilish side because not only does it feel rewarding and strong, it's easier. It's easier in so many ways because you don't engage in self-discipline. You don't check yourself. You don't engage in kindness because kindness carries a cost. And so it's the easier path to indulge that unmitigated, unbridled aggression and ambition. It is the harder path to temper that aggression and ambition with courage and compassion. And so I think that's the eternal struggle, and it manifests itself in different eras in different ways.
So let's break that one down. I'm going to go first because this is, first of all, Star Wars, you know, the light side and the dark side. It's nonsensical way to view humanity.
Yeah, he views
especially since, you know, George Lucas is the one who wrote Democracy Dies to Thunderous Applause. Now, he meant that in a lament, but let's be real. That is historically how democracy dies, to thunderous applause. Whether it's Rome, Germany did kill their democracy. I think it'll happen in America. And if democracy dies in America, it will be to thunderous applause. So going back to his World War II analogy, and people flock to the western parts of Germany so they wouldn't get genocided by communists. They didn't flock because they loved democracy or thought that democracy and liberalism were good. They just did not want to get genocided by the Reds.
Yeah, they didn't want the mass rape of the East German front by the Bolsheviks to happen, which, again, we supplied them. The only reason they had equipment was because we gave it to them on lend-lease. We gave them trains, we gave them planes, we gave them guns. And munitions.
Trucks as well.
Yes.
Trains, so planes,
the only reason they were even able to do that terror that made all those people flock to the Western Front was because we gave the Soviets, you can't say that, oh, we were the compassionate ones against the Soviets, when no, we were on both sides of the equation.
Yeah, so, and that's just a reality of the war. The Eastern Front was the Western Front, even D-Day, that was a secondary front. I mean, maybe not from our perspective, but from the German perspective, the main fight was on the east. That was where the main fight was. And obviously any secondary front takes away resources from the primary front. So there's strategic importance going on here. But it's not a good analogy because he ignores the Soviet equation, the Soviet problem that would have driven Germans to surrender to the
No, Western allies. No, he ignores our involvement in the Soviet.
Well, that too, but let's just focus on why are those people fleeing? It's not because they love democracy or think that it's virtuous.
Yes.
It's just that they don't want to die.
Yeah. I mean, and also the villainization.
It's very tone deaf.
Can we just talk about the villainization of the German soldier?
Yeah.
Like, we're not even talking about the SS or, like, Hitler or, like, anyone in his inner
circle.
We're
talking about the Wehrmacht, average Wehrmacht soldier.
Yes, the average draftee who is, again, no different than the American soldier fighting opposite of him. You know, a lot of those American soldiers, a lot of them were German, too. You know, especially if they were from that Midwest. Then you had some Italians. And you know,
yeah, I mean, I'm trying Italians. To... I maybe said this in the past, like, movies did not villainize the soldiers until... I'm trying to think of when, like, Saving Private Ryan definitely does.
Well, you do have a lot of that in the Vietnam films, which villainize the American soldiers, which, again, is an inaccurate portrayal, honestly. And that is kind of like the revisionist history of Vietnam that Hollywood often portrayed. So there is that side. But yeah, villainizing the German soldiers. You don't even see that in Midway.
You don't see that in Midway with the Japanese, who were way worse.
They are still presented as competent enemies, like almost honorary, like their honor cultures.
A bridge too far. Again, there's nothing really villainous there. It's just they're an adversary to that we're besting, that we're trying to overcome.
Like those people were serving their country honorably, like.
Yeah, and then even like Hogan's hero is more cartoon villain, like it's a comedy, but it's a comedy, it's an intentional comedy, but they don't like over villainize the people. Like they make like Colonel Klink is still likable. Like you still like him even though he's like completely stupid.
And again, the scenarios of their countries of them growing up. I mean, yeah, you have the American side that grew up still in the Great Depression. Germany had their Great Depression already and they came out of it on the other side. So again, the notion that they just were so different and so opposite, and they made this opposite choice is just completely idiotic. I mean, again, he doesn't mention the Civil War, but that's like saying, oh, the North was fighting for freedom and the South was fighting to preserve their slavery system. It's just like, no, the South were fighting for their homeland too.
Actually, the North might have been fighting for
aggression as.
Yeah. No, my point was going to be the North was not necessarily fighting for their homeland because so many of their draftees were immigrants, like fresh off the boat. Fresh off the boat, give them a uniform, you know, oh, you're Irish, you're fighting. So maybe that's why they call it the Fighting Irish. But yeah, they weren't. So the South was 100% fighting for their homeland. The North, less than 100%.
Yeah, but he's trying to like essentially assign motives based on his modern conception of the war.
Yes.
And it's the same thing we do with the Civil War. It's the same, you know, we assign the motives of the war. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It is totally your post-war consensus. You know, everything's black versus white, you know.
Everything's Star Wars.
Yes.
Because and I bet his takes on Star Wars are terrible. Because David French, just as a reminder, he is the only guy that I am, only public figure that I'm aware of that thought Rings of Power was a good TV show. And he also called the new Superman movie glorious, his words. And every clip I've seen of it looks trash. Just saying, because, you know, he's got Star Wars brain, which to some degree, Star Wars was based off of World War II. So that's not, you know, it's not completely, it is definitely, it definitely follows that his post-war consensus mind makes everything a Star Wars analogy. You know, he has a Star Wars view of world history, but in reality, you know, all nations now really face the same problems, which they do allude to, you know, birth rate decline. I think they're going to allude to it in the third clip that I'm about to play.
I mean, so like again,
birth rate decline. That is the biggest problem facing the world. Birth rates,
I would say,
and
I would
immigration,
say,
but they're really one issue. They're
I would say third world immigration is number one. Birth rates. I mean, again, you take care of the
immigration. Well, they're one issue.
Yes and no. You take care of the immigration problem. Like, okay, yeah, birth rates, even if they collapse, well, guess who still makes the kids? Oh, so it's white evangelicals that are having on average more kids, and they outpopulate the left, and then they take over the culture, and then, you know, those Doug Wilson post-mill vision of this Christianized America. Well, it happens. Why? Because we didn't allow immigration and we, you know, just right. naturally had a course correction.
Right. The population might drop, but it'll spike again. It'll be like,
it'll eventually market. Spike again.
We'll be back yeah. better than ever in terms of our population growth, but yes. we,
it's kind of like
crush
the
our own people. Yeah. But we'll crush our own people if we, you know, replace them and, you know, idiocracy becomes a real thing where.
I mean, someone, yeah. in another sense, it might be called colony collapse, you know, kind of like you overstress in a group, an animal or a hive, and then it just dies.
Yeah. Didn't they do an experiment with like mice where yes. they gave the mice perfect conditions? And then eventually when it got to a certain level, it would always collapse. And the mice would even, you know, practice like degeneracy, you know, and stuff like that. Like they would reject their natural urges because they were too crowded and they would always collapse in their population. So.
Well, there's does a notion that if you overwork a society, it will collapse. Right. That's what's happening in Korea.
Yeah. Korea is a very fascinating It's a fascinating case study because you also have the Northern Koreans as well. Last clip, make it count. This is David French talking about zero-sum game a little bit more.
Jordan, I'll tell you another story that I think would be encouraging to you. I was in a meeting, one of these meetings, you know, I call them save the world meetings where you get a bunch of people into a room and everyone's talking about what's wrong with the culture and what's wrong with everything and what can we do to fix it. And this room was much more left-leaning. There was a few conservatives in there. I was in there, a couple other people. But one thing that was so striking, woman after woman at the meeting stood up and said, we need to be reaching young men and we need to be telling young men we love them. I'm a mom of boys and I love my boys and I do not want this culture telling my boys there's something wrong with them. And this was happening in left-leaning spaces, not far left, not like radical left, but in left-leaning spaces. And so I think, and I have seen it with my own eyes, that there is a desperate hunger in America, broad America, for constructive mentoring of young men. Another thing, you may have followed this, but Admiral William McRaven, who was the...
Kind of wanted to weigh in on the parent thing because my observation is that there are normies-based parents, normie parents, but then there's a lot of parents that I would say are implicitly or explicitly raising their kids to be gay.
Well, again, I don't actually know what
I've seen this.
Yes.
I'm sure everyone here has seen this. A parent that's definitely raising their kid to be a catamite. So how many of those parents voted for Donald Trump?
Well, again, we don't actually know what the scenario in his left-leaning group is. Is it like their children, their sons particularly, are struggling to get gainful employment because of all the DEI policies that are basically keeping them out of the workplace? Now, I saw the graphic today. It basically says that the job market is basically the equivalent of a man's experience in the dating market, where you're going to send out like 10,000 applications and you might get like 50 interviews. And that's how bad the market has become. It's like, you know, it used to be in like 2018 to 2020, it was like 10 job postings resulted in 8 jobs. Now it's 4 in 10. So it's a 50% decline, which means 6 in 10 job postings are ghost jobs. They don't get filled. Something happens. Maybe it gets pulled and then they hire an H-1B instead. So then.
Yeah, I saw when you posted that was, it's definitely something that resonates in my experience I've seen a lot of ghost listings and stuff like that.
So is that the scenario that David French is talking about where the parents can't help their children get gainful employment? Because, again, the policies that they support on the left, and not saying that the Republicans haven't been anti-white, too, because they have. But, yeah, there's that. You know, you've got plenty of Cato Institute guys that want to import infinity immigrants, Elon Musk included. So, I mean, is he talking about that? Is he talking about, or is he doing the concern trolling that these parents are concerned that their children are going right wing and in all these group chats and like, you know, they're Hortler posting on the internet? Like, is that the concern that we're not reaching men because they're going to the right?
Okay. So,
there's two avenues of concern.
You just reminded me of like the Destiny streamer whose son is apparently like, you know, mustache man posting or whatever, which I just think is hilarious considering who Destiny is. You know, the guy who's famously cucked himself and all that.
I can't blame him for going in a like the completely opposite direction of his father. Like right. That's just, it makes sense.
Yeah, because there's a masculinity crisis. And how much of this masculinity crisis, actually, well, same question. How many of the moms in the group that David French was talking about were single moms?
Yeah, another good question.
Yeah, and we're not going to get an answer to that, but let's just make that a broad, let's go back to the first thing I was going to ask, which was how much of this masculinity crisis is driven by single motherhood?
Well, a bunch of it.
Again, first of all, like the kids that are being raised to be, you know, flaming. Yeah, a lot of single moms there. Or like impoverished sort of white trashy culture.
Well,
does that just, as well.
Yeah, but, inner city ghetto.
But there's a lot of that. So how much of this is driven by single mothers? Obviously, there's the movie Fight Club, which totally leans hard into this. The themes that we're kind of discussing and that is discussed in this video. But from a Gen X perspective or Gen X or older millennial perspective.
I mean, yeah, especially in the late 90s, this was openly acknowledged to be a thing. Even like Falling Down, which is early 90s, but as you get towards late 90s, you have like three major movies that are certainly like well-regarded to this day where, yeah, you have Fight Club, you have, Office Space, and then you even have American Beauty with Kevin Spacey. Like that's basically his job or his thing is like he loses his focus there. He and again they do the same bit of what exactly do you do here, and he basically just tells off his boss and then he gets a severance package from his job. So the idea of like working dead-end jobs and menial, like essentially having lacking purpose, dead marriages.
Well, millennials were taught to pursue a career, like one career. And that's definitely not how the job market turned out, where people are just hopping jobs all over the place. That's what ends up being the case by the time millennials enter the workforce for the most part. But we're told, hey, you're going to choose one career in your life, or, you know, that's what you should be looking for. You should be looking for one thing to do and work towards that. And that's just not how real life works. Maybe it worked like that for some people, but,
Well, let me read this off. So I saw this chart today. It's from the Federal Reserve. And it was basically the unemployment rate of college graduates by degree. And this is 22 to 27 year olds.
Are you able to share screen?
Yeah, I can go ahead.
I can stop sharing for a second.
Yeah, I saw this earlier today.
Because again, you know, job market's very important. And it's a lot different for younger men than it was obviously 50 years ago. 50 years ago, I feel like you had to have tried to not have a job worldwide, you know, globally in the US. Now it's pretty difficult to find a job. Compare, you know, and, you know, a little bit of a personal story is like I've started to do a little bit of hiring process. And, you know, I've gotten like one candidate that's qualified for the job and that I want that I'd be willing to hire. There's a story behind the other person that's technically qualified, but maybe that'll be some more paywall content because that's pretty juicy.
So
here we go.
Looking at this chart, obviously these are the top 15 unemployment rates by major. And if you're looking at just the top 10, STEM. Five of the top 10 are STEM. That's physics, computer engineering. No, I'm not calling graphic design STEM. It's not. Chemistry, computer science, information technology.
That's really shocking, but it's also not
shocking. It's not.
I've worked in IT. It is very difficult to get an interview in IT. Now, maybe if you're a foreigner who lies about his certifications, you can get a lot of interviews. Like that one, or you're like that one guy who apparently had like 21 jobs. And was continuously getting onboarded at other companies in Silicon Valley.
I mean, like, again, I could understand, okay, anthropology, that's limited.
That's been a joke of a program.
Fine arts, I can understand. Right. Like, but chemistry, computer science, physics, computer engineering, you know, those STEM jobs that we say we need
I'm surprised you don't see something like criminal justice up there.
I mean, we told all these people learn to code, and then, you know, the coding jobs aren't there, or, you know, you have a lot of tech companies that laid people off.
Yeah. I would not recommend a career in IT. I just wouldn't, based on my own experience. But, and you again, know, I'm also someone who has zero certifications.
And again,
so take that for what it's worth.
Those are STEM jobs. Those are male jobs, primarily.
So I don't regret for a second leaving STEM. I don't regret for a second leaving it. All right. So let's get back to the video with Jordan Peterson. Finish the last clip. Where we're going to get more into like the gender wars.
But again, the solutions to those problems are, again, not importing immigrants and getting rid of DEI policies, which again, the Democrats can't offer because those would benefit essentially the cohort that doesn't vote for them.
Well, yeah, because they don't, David French doesn't offer a real solution here other than, oh, we need to have virtuous compassion and model that. But he doesn't offer any practical examples of that. Like, to me, the compassion thing is we're going to deport people who don't belong in this country so we can lower the cost of housing, we can lower traffic, we can lower crime, and we can have our country back. That's the compassionate thing to do, is to do mass deportations. You want to hear about the uncompassionate thing to do? Well, no, you could get banned on YouTube for that. So deportations are the merciful option. I just want to be very clear about that. And let mercy triumph over justice.
Admiral who headed American Special Forces, directed Operation Neptune Spear, which killed bin Laden. Just a remarkable American man, American story, American role model. You know, he gave a commencement speech at UT Austin several years ago, and it's known as the Make Up Your Bed speech. Mm-hmm, it's a theme that you've articulated as well. Millions and millions and millions of views for that thing. It has been just spread and metastasized all over America, and not just in conservative spaces. And so that's what I think is encouraging. Lots of people in that big American middle are saying, waking up and saying something here is wrong. And that's why the response to the Times article was more positive, I think, than people might expect. The other thing, going to the bigger, deeper question, you know, I get so tired of like the concept of the gender wars the way our political parties exploit gender gaps. So, you know, the way our political parties come in and say, the Republicans might say, well, we win more with men than with women. So I'm going to really dive in with men. Or the Democrats say, we win more with women than men. And they really dive in with women, which means we have these giant engines of cultural and political influence who are exacerbating gender and sex disagreements as part of their political project, right? And so it's creating the sense that, and rather than we're all in this together and that you cannot have, you know, women in America at writ large cannot be in a healthy place unless men in America are in a healthy place and vice versa. Men, you know, so the idea that we're all in this together, that this is not a zero-sum game, I think that's a message that has to be repeated and repeated and repeated, that the success of men does not mean the failure of women, the success of women does not mean the failure of men. And, you know, I don't know that here's the way I would put, I don't have the same perspective of you about corporate evil and all of that, but I will say this, I do think that one thing that really distresses me is that we see people having fewer kids than they say they want to have, and we see people getting married later than they say they want to get married, or not getting married at all when they say they want to get married. And I think we have this gap between people's desires, the deepest desires and longings of their heart, and their actual lives, what's actually happening in their lives, that is really putting a pall of anxiety and failure and hopelessness over American life. So what is it that we can do to close this gap between your heart's longing and the reality of your life? And by the way, longing for children and longing for a marriage I don't think everybody, as a Christian who believes in the Bible, it's very plain from scripture that not everybody has to be married. But if you're somebody, marriage is a wonderful institution. It's wonderful for me. So saying I want to get married, that's a good thing. Saying I want to have kids, that's a good thing. And how can we narrow that gap between the heart's longing and the reality? Honestly, Jordan, I think that's one of the central cultural and political projects of our time. And it's why neither party has been able to win a commanding majority for anything more than a 2 to 4 year period in the last generation, is that so many millions of Americans feel like their dreams are out of their reach. And they're looking everywhere for a solution to this. And in the political sphere, they're definitely not getting it.
So he's talking about young Americans and then extrapolating that onto how politics has worked in the United States.
Well,
young voters are not the people driving the election results. And maybe that's changed in the last two cycles. But for the most part, it's not the young voters chasing their dreams and their dissatisfaction with chasing their dreams that has driven the election results in this country. Except, again, I think 2022 and 2024, you can make a case for that.
Well, I mean, let's just back up a bit. He's trying to say, okay, Democrats are diving into women, Republicans are diving into men. No, Donald Trump is diving into men, not the Republican Party. The Republican Party is still Longhouse. They are still in the cuck chair. You got, again, goes back to Mike Johnson blaming the gamer bros for abusing the welfare state.
Instead, Nancy Mace being a
whore, the biggest whore in politics. Yeah. I mean, the only thing she hasn't done is, like, you know, shown the full Monty, even though she promised it. But yeah, I mean, that's the Republican Party. It's Nancy Mace, it's Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's
divorced women,
all three divorced.
And today, a Republican in the Texas Senate announced that she was getting a divorce, that it was a biblical divorce. She didn't claim that adultery was.
Yeah, Ken Paxton's wife, who's only in the Texas Senate because of who she married. So
that was Ken Paxton's wife?
Yes.
Did she? Wow.
And as he's running as a challenger for the Senate, I believe. So yeah, you have all these like women that the Republican Party is longhoused. If they actually wanted to like dive into men as a party, they would be talking about turning off the welfare faucet, like, and stop giving single mothers like welfare that they shouldn't be getting. Stop rewarding them for having kids out of wedlock.
Well, here's the thing. You're talking about a men versus women dynamic in politics, but what issue do women prioritize the most? Especially in light of the fact that you talked about people not having as many children as they want to have. Political issue do women prioritize the most? The right to kill their own children.
Better than that. The right to essentially have unprotected sex with someone whose kids they don't want.
I think what I said was better.
Right to, well, yeah, but the right to fall. Again, unprotected sex, we generally say raw dog, but so I'm trying to censor myself a little bit. But yeah, that's, you know, the right to be whores and the right to kill the child. That's their number one issue.
And that's been the case since the 19th Amendment was ratified. That's really has been the case. And that's still the case. That hasn't changed.
Third world immigrants.
What did Kamala Harris lean into with women? The abortion issue, 2022, after Roe v. Wade was overturned, what'd they say? Row, row, row your vote and stuff like that. So the Democrats lean into the abortion issue because, again, that's what single women, not married women, but single women vote overwhelmingly because of the issue of abortion. And that again, is their driving issue.
And the reason the pro-life movement is a failure is because all they do is try to lean into women when they should be leaning into men. They should be saying, hey, abortion is unvirtuous. It is disgusting. Women that get this are trash. They are vile. They are heathens.
Shame culture.
They are disgusting because abortion is disgusting. And people who get it are disgusting. That should be your message. It should be completely a red pill manosphere message. And that would move men to the right on abortion, which will eventually drag the women to the right.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you should be making memes about how gross it is that a woman's had this many abortions. Like, that should be the message.
And again, I wrote this article way back. When the Democrats had their little abortion booth outside their convention, just look at the images of the women that went into that booth. Overweight, ugly. You wouldn't want to. You know, would not. And that's the face of abortion. Like,
it really is.
It's not a pretty, it's not, it don't look like, you know, Sydney
serial
Sweeney.
Killer.
It doesn't look like Sydney Sweeney. It looks like Zendaya, you know?
Okay.
Probably worse. It looks, yeah.
It looks like it ate Zendaya. Yeah.
It looks like Lizzo.
At least if I'm recalling the Democrat abortion bit at the convention is like, yeah, this woman ate Zendaya. But anyway.
Like, you have to tailor your message in a way that will actually work. And Donald Trump changed the game, and he won.
Let's get some questions from the people sent in while we're talking, while we're kind of concluding our thoughts on this. Because, again, David French tries to talk about a zero-sum game, but there is no compromising. There's no compromising as a man with, you know, abortion on demand for any reason at all.
Well, again, the Democrats are increasingly an anti-white party, not just an anti-male party. So
that is true. But you are seeing men of all races break away a little bit. So
not really with the blacks. I mean,
not really.
Trump's numbers were a little relatively. I mean, he was like 1%. He didn't move.
Hey, he got Antonio Brown.
Yeah,
that guy has the best Twitter account.
Yeah, some very high personality or some very high profile personalities with high profile problems.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, maybe one day I'll be cracker.
Like he improved with, you know, again, you just need to win more white men and then you're winning more elections. You're winning those Rust Belt states that you need to win.
Yeah. And if the Republicans can get convince white people to stop hating themselves, like the Northeast will actually flip. Maine will go back to being Maine and New Hampshire will become red states at this trajectory
or Minnesota, probably the easiest of the,
no, because of the Somalia thing. But I imagine a lot of these states, the young people have rejected the Northern boomer, liberalism, and they're more conservative than, you know, at least the white people in the Northeast. Now, what's interesting is, can the church use this as a mission field? Because ultimately, I do think that's more the solution. You need to Christ pill these people. But practically speaking, their dissatisfaction is warranted. You need to, first of all, Christ pill them. Second of all, offer practical solutions. Well, and I think Christians can do both of these things.
And keep in mind, he's acting like, oh, no one's actually working for them. Yeah, no one in Congress is working for them. I mean, but again, you can't say Donald Trump hasn't. I mean, again, if you are young and you want a job, maybe, I mean, and you're, you know, in decent shape, ICE is hiring. There's some jobs for some men.
Like that is a very promising, you know, you can get some good experience, and I imagine they have a good retirement package.
I'm hearing, like, you know, word on the street is if you wanted to join the military just for tactical reasons, get your 4 years or whatever, now is the time. So, again, Trump is improving a lot of opportunities for men.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't see any questions coming in, but I do want to say, if you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channels of the podcast if you are new subs. Help with the magical YouTube algorithms. Also, maybe liking works on live streams, but I don't actually think liking actually does anything for the algorithm on a video, but that's just my theory. New subs is what does it every single time. There's your behind the, you know, inside baseball on YouTube. So, fun times, as always. I do want to say, I want to give a teaser. I've been working all week on something that's a big project. I'm not like in charge of this project, but it's someone else's big project, and it's a pretty exciting project. I look forward to being able to announce it in the future, but a lot of things happening right now. And you can also check out, we have a free newsletter at Evangelical Dark Web, and, yeah, least you can do is like and subscribe if you're new. Most you can do is a Patreon-like system where you get access to bonus content. So, I am not seeing anything else. So, I think we can wrap up. That's all we got for today. My name is Ray. This is Anthony. This is the Evangelical Dark Web. Stay based, Christ is King, and we will catch you on the next one.